Starting up here. And we'll be able to share the recording whenever the folks that weren't able to make it. But I will let you take it away. And thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time tonight. And we look forward to hearing what you have to say.
All right. Let me figure out how to share with Google. And go to it now. And I want to share window. This one. Let me know when you see my slides.
Yep, they're coming up now.
Okay. So,
beautiful scenery without the snow.
It is. So for everyone on the line tonight, if you haven't been to the West Lafayette campus, sort of the Purdue University mothership, if you will, we're known for our fountains. And when I was an undergrad in West Lafayette, this fountain here, this is in the engineering mall. So all the colleges are kind of clustered around their major domain and the engineering. So we've got Kimmy, nuclear, EE, MSEE, and all the other engineering disciplines are surrounded by this fountain where there's a metal column that the water shoots out of. Well, when I was an undergrad, there was no metal column. So you could run through the fountain. And apparently after too many fraternity parties, people would slip and fall. So they put this metal cylinder so you couldn't run through it anymore. But if you get a chance to visit, it's still a wonderful place to sunbathe and get wet on a hot day.
Very funny.
So good evening, good day, good afternoon. If you're serving overseas, thank you and good evening, wherever you might be. My name is George Bailey. I've done a stint with Dean Burton did a certificate program as a university employee. We get the gift of knowledge, so you know we're able to attend Purdue Global programming for free. And I was in between graduate programs, and I thought, well, let's give this thing a shot. And I really loved it. And I, at some point, will go back to get yet another credential of some kind when time permits. But life's pretty busy right now. What I had planned for this evening is to talk about the Cybersecurity Maturity Model certification. It's yet another security framework that, as a cyber professional, you will become aware of and possibly intimately knowledgeable of at some point in your career, probably sooner than later. But that's what I had. And, you know, we can make this as interesting as you like, as dynamic as you like. So please stop me with questions. I can't really monitor the chat, so if someone could just let me know if there's a question, and I'll shut up and listen, and we can take it from there.
Will do.
So about me, three-time Purdue graduate, three and a half if you consider my Purdue Global interaction. I'm a licensed K-12 teacher, so I came to Purdue in the early 90s to get a computer science degree because I wanted to teach high school programming. I graduated in the mid-90s, and high school curriculum in the computer science area was not where I thought it needed to be. And when I was at Purdue, I had worked an IT job my entire 4 years. So I basically just went into IT. I've maintained my teaching license, and maybe that'll be my second career when I hang up the consulting hat. Loving husband, I have four children, two of which are college aides. One of is out of the home. So if you hear some rumblings in the background, that's probably my family. I have 25 years of technology experience, 17 of which is purely in InfoSec. That's what we call it when you're an old guy, cybersecurity now. And I'm definitely a very open social networker, open for connections. So I like to mentor young professionals. I'm always posting links to new jobs, and I like to introduce young professionals to senior connections that I have. So if you're soon to be in the job market, definitely connect with me on LinkedIn and Twitter. I'll be glad to try to help you find your first role. So with that, let's talk about the agenda that I sort of had planned for this evening. All right. So why do we get another cybersecurity framework? All right. We've got ISO, we've got COBIT, we've got AGTIL, we've got ISO, we have a variety of NIST standards. And that's just the ones that we use here in the United States. When you look at international standards, you know, there's ones from NISA, and there's from, you know, the Australian Directorate has lots of good cyber guidance and requirements. The UK has their own. So we're going to dig into why we need another cybersecurity framework and really who the audience of that framework is. And that framework is cybersecurity maturity model certification. So hopefully when you walk away from this, you'll at least understand yet another acronym and at least give an elevator pitch to what that means and who it impacts. We're doing it's labeled a CMMC deep dive, but really as much as I can get through in the time that we have tonight, you're not going to be a CMMC expert, but I think you'll be able to at least do a discussion post, wink, wink, about it this week. So certification process and what's it take for an organization to receive a certification of the cybersecurity maturity model. And then we're going to talk about some of the observed difficulties that I've seen as I've been bouncing around the state of Indiana doing consulting for small to medium businesses. So with that, if you have any questions, again, stop me and let's dig into this, because you know the content, like most cyber material, can get dry unless you're really into the material. So you know you're probably very familiar with the US F-35 fighter, but have you seen the Japanese J-35 or the Chinese, J-35? Looks strikingly similar, doesn't it? That's because several years ago, attribution is hard in cybersecurity, you know this, but it is believed that a Chinese nation state APT had stolen the plans for the F-35 fighter. And now they have a J-35 fighter. And through some reverse engineering from our intelligence agencies, we've discovered that they've actually copied the flaws in the designs of the F-35. So they didn't really take much effort to improve the intellectual property that they had, that they hacked into the systems and stole. So it's no big secret that the supply chain is a big issue these days, right? 40 large defense companies were impacted in a SolarWinds breach. And you think, well, 40, that's not that bad. 40 businesses, you know, SolarWinds had 18,000 clients supposedly and gotten the rogue update to their Orion network management system. But when you think about a large defense contractor, their supply chains could be thousands of vendors. So depending on the connectivity that they have with their supply chain and their partners and their subcontractors, 40 large defense companies that had a nation state, you know, backdoor access to their network is a big deal. The bigger they are, the harder they fall, right? Just because you have $1 billion budgets doesn't mean that you are any more capable of defending that teeny tiny little vulnerability that you haven't discovered and no one's discovered, right? Because you have a $1 billion cyber budget doesn't mean that you are immune to zero-day vulnerabilities. So in June of this year, a nuclear weapons contractor was, you know, they released a disclosure, public notice that, you know, they were a victim of ransomware. So, and as you know, most ransomwares this day and age, it's not just about locking up the data. They want you to pay. So they're going to exfiltrate that data and release it to the public. So in this case, if a nuclear weapons contractor who likely does have sensitive information, if that data was exfiltrated, you know, what does that mean for our national safety? So the supply chain's a big deal. The supply chains across the Department of Defense has seen compromises, and it doesn't seem to really slow down much. And then when you look at the makeup of what is serving the DIB, as they call it, the Defense Industrial Base, it's all the companies that provide products and services to the U.S. Department of Defense. 74% of these defense contractors are small. They're third and fourth tier suppliers. You know, they might be just doing a heat treatment. They might be doing coding. They're milling out a widget or a wing nut that falls into a much larger defense system. They may not even know that what they're making is going to be on the next Black Hawk helicopter because they're three or four tiers down. But if they're the weakest link, right, if you can compromise a fourth tier supplier and use their credentials to access GE Aviation or Rolls-Royce or one of the primes that they're getting their work orders from, you possibly could harvest a lot more data. Another interesting thing about these smaller three, fourth tier manufacturers, these are micro size organizations. We're talking in some cases, 50 employees or less. Very rarely do they have an IT person. They have no security person. They generally have an MSP, a managed service provider, but those are generally a break fix relationship, right? They call them when the printer doesn't work, or they call them when they get a new employee and they've got to set up a new PC. There's no strategic guidance about how they do role-based access control. There's no guidance on how do we do key escrow for our, even as simple as our SSL certificates. And when it comes to full disk or mobile device encryption, there's none of that. So, you know, considering 74% of the DIB are these small organizations, the Department of Defense thought that, you know, we need to do something to secure up the weakest link, if you will. So that's one of the reasons why we need yet another cybersecurity framework, right? The folks that are supplying the U.S. Department of are all shapes and sizes. They're all experiencing breaches of some kind, right? They're all being targeted in phishing. And all it takes is one, you know, hastily click, and, you know, a supply chain for a particular product could technically be compromised. The current NIST standards, they're only required for government agencies to follow. They're great guidance, but, you know, private industries are not legislatively, you know, they're not regulated to follow NIST guidance. And in many cases, they are meant to address the most sensitive information, the secret, the top secret, the top classified data, right? The information that a third and fourth tier contractor is getting, it's not classified, right? It's confidential. It's, you know, it's probably somewhere between financial records and an SSN in some cases. In other cases, it's, you know, very secret. And because of that, you know, the NIST standards just don't scale well to the different levels of the type of sensitivity of the data. It was also thought that the NIST standards were just too rigorous for these small to medium sized companies. And the new framework that they released is still very rigorous. And in most cases, folks are probably going to stop serving the Department of Defense because they can't live up to the requirements. And this model is going to require a third-party attestation. Someone's going to have to come into these organizations, conduct an audit, and basically give them either, yes, you've passed, here's your certification, it's good for an X amount of years, or sorry, try again in 90 days. What came before CMMC? Right? Because CMMC really isn't a thing yet. We're in this is the calm before the storm, right? It's the darkest before the dawn kind of thing. CMMC is a phased in approach, but as of today, right, if you were to go do a consulting project or land a job as a cyber professional in a company serving the defense industrial base, let's say you go work for Lockheed Martin, they are required to follow the NIST 800-171, right? That's the protecting confidentially controlled unclassified information within non-federal information systems. Gotta love NIST and their long names. Basically, it means that data that is classified as sensitive that wouldn't be released to the public has to be protected, right? And you have to follow the NIST 800-171 standard to do that. There's 110 controls. It's, you know, compared that to the 853, where there's 823 controls. So it's drastically smaller, and it's meant to be just a confidentiality, right? There's not a lot of controls that speak to availability, and there's very few controls that speak to integrity. There's a couple that talk about backups, but that's the extent, right? And no integrity monitoring, any of that noise. So if you work for a company, if you go see a company today, this is what they have to abide by. We are waiting on the DFARS final rule, which is supposed to come out in September, which is a phased-in approach from this DFARS. It's going from this NIST 800-171, which was supposed to be, you know, one size fits all. But as you know, I mean, there's organizations that provide services to the Department of Defense that's a sole proprietor. It's one employee, right? So this framework doesn't necessarily map to an organization of one employee. And for the organizations like Lockheed Martin, who get the most sensitive of defense information, it's not good enough. So CMMC is really meant to bridge the gap to support all of those different size organizations, right? So this standard doesn't scale to the smallest or the biggest. General compliance language didn't take into account the actual sensitivity of data, right? So if you're selling just commercial off-the-shelf products to the Department of Defense, maybe you're doing IT integration at a military installation. Well, you're not doing anything secret. You're procuring Dell or HP or Lenovo equipment, and you're setting it up. But because you have a relationship with DoD, that information about the contract might be considered sensitive. Not necessarily public, but not risk to national security kind of thing. In the DFARS rule 7012, so the law of the land today, all organizations needed to do a self-attest. They would send a CIO to their procurement office or an email to the CIO of the DoD procurement office and say, yeah, we're good. We looked at the standard and we meet all the controls. And I can tell you, I've assessed small organizations and I've assessed large organizations, and I've yet to find anybody that meets the 800-171 controls, right? There's always something that's missing. So what is CMMC? It's a cybersecurity maturity model. It's built off of Carnegie Mellon's software development model, right? Because the idea was not every organization needs to be as secure as the next. So there are multiple levels, and each level is progressively gets more intense in the number of controls and the verbosity of what you have to do as an organization to maintain the confidentiality of this CUI. So what needs to be protected? There's two things. There's either federal contracting information or this controlled unclassified data. Federal contract information is really, it's more of, hey, I'm gonna sell you 25 of these widgets at X amount of cost. It's not necessarily, there's no government specifications, there's no schematics, there's nothing in that contract that necessarily says what that product is. Maybe there's a part number, if there's an internal part number that you use to communicate what you're selling, but there's not, you know, if it got released to the public, then the public would know, but George Bailey is selling something to the Department of Defense, right? So it's the relation self in itself could be considered sensitive, right? Because if the adversaries know that George Bailey is selling something to the federal government and you can attack George Bailey's company, maybe you can get a leg up on attacking the Department of Defense. And then there's the controlled unclassified information. And this is the information that is considered sensitive, right? So your SSN, it would be considered CUI. It's actually part of the National Archives. Social Security numbers and lots of other financial identifiers are considered controlled unclassified. So what is? Well, I just told you, but it's basically, you know, it's information that is provided by the government. It's not necessarily meant for release to the public. If it got released to the public, it wouldn't be a national security threat. It would just, you know, be something of that the procurement office wouldn't want to be released. Most of the information in FCIs can be requested through a information request act, right? You can go and formally ask for it, but you're not going to know what they're buying. They're just going to know that they're buying something from the company. So what is CUI? Come familiar with this term, because I think at the end of this presentation, you're gonna appreciate that even though this framework is only being used by the Department of Defense and their contractors, it is broad enough, and CUI's classification covers a lot of different things, that as soon as the certification workforce is available, I fully anticipate other industries embracing this model to assess their supply chain, manage their third-party risk. But CUI is basically any information that the government creates or possesses, that an entity creates or possesses on their behalf, and that they want to keep confidential. And basically you have to have these safeguarding and dissemination controls. So you have to protect it from unauthorized disclosures, and you have to make sure it doesn't fall into the wrong hands, right? So when you're sharing it electronically, if you share it physically, if the KUI is a physical artifact, right, you have to make sure that it's accounted for, that people aren't getting a hold of it that that shouldn't have it. Now, KUI does not include classified information. If you plan to work in an environment where classified information, that's a whole different framework at all. That's a whole different structure. This is really meant for private industry in order to keep government data confidential. So what are some of the categories? I underline defense and privacy because defense is where it's starting. And because every industry has some form of privacy regulation or at least intent, I see information that's under the privacy category going to be one of the impetus that forces the CMMC onto other organizations. And these are just broad categories. So you can go to the National Archives. They're the Congress delegated the responsibility to them to categorize KUI. So what's in the defense category? So there's controlled technical information. There's DoD critical infrastructure security information. So if you're providing SOC services or anything, you know, think of it as IT service. If you're providing that and you have information about the layout, the topology of a network, that would be considered sensitive, right? Because an adversary could use that information to further their attack or their nefarious intentions on that infrastructure. Naval nuclear propulsion information. So if you're working with nuclear submarines, anything regarding those vehicles is considered KUI. Doesn't matter what it is. A lot of things is considered classified, but just on the surface. Unclassified controlled nuclear information, defense. So again, this is, you know, anything that's been unclassified but not meant for public release. Most organizations aren't going to have the last two. Those are very niche. But the first two are very probable that you will work for a company at some point that you will have controlled technical information, or you might be providing services to the DoD and you would have access to critical infrastructure, you know, information. So some of the things that you would find in CTI, the controlled technical information, are right in your wheelhouse, right? There's computer software, executable source code, studies and analysis. If you're doing security work, you know, if you work for a security company and you're being your product, let's say that you go work for CrowdStrike, and a DoD agency has implemented CrowdStrike, and you're getting alerts and signatures and all kinds of data feeds from that environment, right? The analysis that you would do as from CrowdStrike's perspective would be considered CTI, and it would have to be protected. The confidentiality that would have to be protected. Research and engineering diagrams. What I typically see is more of the engineering drawings. I work with a lot of manufacturers that are making things. In Indiana, we have about 800 manufacturers that are supplying something to a defense project. I was in a manufacturer today, and they glue, so they get the sort of, if you're looking at a jet engine, right, and you see the blades in the engine, a contractor higher in the supply chain ships them the blades, and they do something with those blades, and then they ship them back. And those blades, there's commercial application that, you know, they go into commercial airliners, but there's also defense applications for that as well. So it was really cool because, you know, you get to see things that you typically wouldn't get to see if you're working with organizations that deal with CTI. Technical reports, technical orders. This list is going to grow and grow and grow. So definitely you will come in contact with CTI at some point in your career. So who has to be certified to this new framework? Currently, only defense contractors have to, because, you know, to do anything government-wide would just take forever. But, you know, the DoD really had some major breaches. They've had some major compromises of major projects. So they thought, we've got to secure our weakest link. And we don't know who that is, but we're going to make this requirement. So eventually, all organizations that are providing services other than commercial off the shelf will have to receive a certification by 2025. So September 2025. So we got what, four years to get this rolled out. I will tell you, we're not going to hit that mark. It is already delayed, and there's a lot of political churn and angst about this model. So, you know, it's likely to change in the next 6 months. So everything I told you could be for naught in 6 months from now, but at least for now, it's accurate. There's a stage rollout so that there's we'll get to it, but there's hundreds of thousands of organizations that have to be assessed, right? So if you just said, okay, everyone had to do it by the end of 2021, there's no one in the workforce who's authorized to certify them. But when they do get certified, it'll be good for 3 years. Originally, this was the plan that was rolled out in September of 2020. It was thought that 15 supply chains would be assessed this year, 75 supply chains next year, 250 the next, and then 475. It's believed there's only about 475 major defense systems that have to be certified. And within those 475 defense systems, there are 300,000 organizations doing something in those 475 systems. But that's a huge number, astronomical number. It is believed that 180,000 of those, so about 60%, will have to be level one. So this is basic hygiene. You know, do your antivirus, do your good authentication, account management, and a few other controls, and you'll be good. 90,000 are believed to be level three. That's 130 controls. That's really a game changer for a lot of these organizations. And 30,000, which I think is a really high estimate, have to be level four and level five, right? These are the progressive, these are the organization with advanced cybersecurity programs. So to give you an idea of kind of how it progresses, level one, you only have to be level one if all you receive is FCI, this federal contract information. So if let's say that you're a tier three provider, tier four, and all you're doing is you're heat treating something. You don't even know what that something is. It fits in your oven and you treat it and you send it back to your customer, right? You know, you have a relationship with a customer, you know what they're sending you, you know what you're doing for them. That could be considered FCI. If it's part of a defense system, you have to be level one. At level two, it's not believed that any certifications will be issued at level two. Level two is meant to be a transition stage from level one to level three. But level one has 17 controls. Level two has 72 controls. So as you start to mature up to level three has 130 controls. Level four has 156. And level five has 171 controls, which is still fairly small relative to the 853 standard, which is NIST, kind of their global catalog for security controls. But to think about it, if you had a company of 50 employees and you had to then implement 171 controls, it's costly, it takes forever, and it's hard to maintain. So this is really going to be a game changer for these small to medium-sized businesses. Got covered that. So the purpose of level one is really to safeguard the FCI. Level three is to protect CUI. And the level four and level five are really meant to reduce risk to APTs, those advanced persistent threats. So these are the folks that, you know, nation states, very highly motivated, very sophisticated adversaries who, right, level four and level five, they need to have advanced controls to keep these folks out. And more importantly, to identify when they're in the environment. Where are the controls coming from? Very similar to the NIST 853 control families. There's 17 control families, if my math's right. So any one of these have a number of controls in them. So right, obviously access control, asset management, how can you protect something that you don't know you have, right? Audit and accountability, awareness training. These should look very similar to you, familiar, because they're in every framework known to man when it comes to cybersecurity. break down to some of these control families, you can see how level one has just really, it only touches 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 of the 17 control families. Access control, identification, authentication, media protection, physical protection, right? You gotta protect your facilities. If you can touch the device, you can own the device. System and communication protection, and system and information integrity. So basically the 17 controls for level one have to do with, do you know who your users are? Do they have unique credentials? Do you have antivirus? Is it running? Do you have scheduled scans? Do you conduct scheduled scans? Do you have physical controls on your facility, right? Do you inventory your keys, your tokens, or your card access, depending on how you secure your facility? And that's pretty much it. It is really basic hygiene. It's what any business should be doing anyway, but I still find that many organizations aren't doing these things. Level three, the dark purple there, that's where stuff really gets heated up. What's the certification process? And I want to spend a little bit of time here, because as future cyber professionals, this is something that there's no better time than now to get in sort of the ground floor of this, because organizations are not going to be audited by the government. There's a accreditation body that is, it's a nonprofit, 503C, I believe, but they are producing training. And so you as a cyber professional can go and become a certified assessor for the CMMC model. So organizations would hire you through what they call this third party assessing organization. You don't necessarily have to work for C3PAO. You can, but C3PAOs have to be certified themselves. And then they hire certified assessors to go out and assess these organizations. And if I were to go back just a few slides, we already know that there's going to be a lot of certification activity, and these organizations have to be certified, recertified every 3 years. So they're going to need a lot of assessors. On-site interviews, there's policy documentation reviews, physical inspection of facilities, there's validation, the document procedures are being followed. So the way that I do that, typically like today I went in, I did a complete vulnerability scan of the entire, they had a /21 network. So what is that, about 2,500 IP addresses. But it's a small organization. They were only using 100 of them, but they had this massive network. So I scanned it all. I did benchmark reviews of their domain controller, of their Windows systems, right? To get an idea of, you say you're doing this, but you still have to validate. And in many cases, you're going to have to ask for two forms of evidence, right? They might say, well, our operational practice is this. Okay, great. Show me. And then they got to produce that they're actually following that operational practice. Or they can say, oh, we have a policy. They show you the policy. Oh, it looks great. But it's just vaporware, right? There's no evidence that the policy is even being followed. So it's going to be an interesting task for new assessors, because no one's been assessed yet. So we're kind of waiting for the pilot ones to get done so that we can inform the assessing community of really how to do these things. But if you go to the cmmcab.org, you can sign up. And unfortunately, the training is not free, right? So, but you know, if you land a job somewhere, hopefully they'll send you the training to get your CMMC certified assessor credential, and then you work anywhere. Interesting thing about the assessment that we've only learned this recently from one of the C3PAOs. There's only four of them in the United States. And none of them have been authorized by the DoD to actually certify assessments yet. But during their certification process, they had leaked that one of them didn't make it. But they said they were given 90 days to remediate and then to come back, right? So they had less than, a little bit more than 10% of the controls not implemented. The interesting thing that I thought was they're leaving of that 90-day remediation window, only 75 days to fix things, and they're giving 15 days to reassess. And I can tell you, as someone who goes into organizations and does evaluation for a living, 15 days to do a reassessment is a really long time for a small business, right? Today, I sat around a table with the CEO, the CEO's wife, their son, right? So the three primary owners, and then their one IT guy. And if I had to do that for 15 days, their business would be non-existent. So it's interesting how much time that they're giving auditors to actually validate these controls. I typically do it in 2 days on site and then do a lot of desk stuff. So if you have more than 10% of the controls as a gap, or you haven't addressed two of those 17 control families, it's just a failure. At some point, you have to recontract for another assessment sometime down the road. Pain points. So things that I've seen just this summer alone that's really causing problems with folks getting ready. So I go in and I do these readiness assessments because no one can get certified yet. The auditors aren't there. The CPAOs aren't there to assess them. But they know the framework, so they know what they have to do. And they can have you, folks like me, come in and evaluate them. So IT and information security practices, they're just not documented, right? So yeah, they might have robust antivirus controls, but there's no governance around that, right? So it's installed everywhere. It's only installed because they're using Windows Defender, and they'd actually have to do something to turn it off. But in some cases where they have a commercial solution, all they can say is we have it installed. They can't tell me where they have it installed, right? And in some cases, they even have a dashboard, but they don't do asset inventory, so they don't know. They know where they have it installed. They just don't know if they have it installed everywhere because they don't know if everything is in the asset inventory. Multi-factor authentication is lacking for privileged access. So one of the controls in CMMC is that all remote access has to be MFA'd, but then any privileged access. So even if you are a domain administrator, you're an IT person, you're working for a company, if you were to do anything using domain level admin or even local level admin on a critical system, it has to be MFA controlled. And a lot of folks haven't done that yet on internal access. Ineffective or no log retention or correlation practices. So really no SIM, no analytics to their logs. In many cases, they're not logging at all, other than what's OEM or turned on by default. Incident response and handling capabilities are break fix. They're not root cause analysis. In many cases, if something gets a malware on it, if they can't remediate it with the antivirus controls, they might re-image it. And that's it. They don't go to determine, well, how did it get here? You know, they don't do any threat hunting. They don't figure out where else is impacted in the organization. And that's not going to get them, right? They have to be able to close an incident and have root cause analysis. That's one of the requirements. Lack of robust network monitoring, cyber threat intelligence capabilities. It goes back to the lack of logging, but really even without logging, there's a lot of opportunities for professionals like you to get in there and teach organizations how to securely monitor their network. Lots of open source, of course, lots of commercial tools to get familiar with. Cyber threat intelligence capabilities for the level 4 and level 5, they want those organizations to contribute data back to threat intelligence feeds. So not just ingest cyber threat intelligence and act on it, but they want you to inform the community based on the incidents that you have. I've yet to see anybody who has that capability or even the willingness to share threat intelligence externally. So long-term impacts, this is going to usher in a new wave of third-party risk management, kind of like PCI did with the financial industry. Banks pushed down to merchants that they had to be PCI compliant if they took even a single credit card transaction. For the reg, they didn't need to be at that threshold, but it was a requirement that their merchant banks and their processors were pushing down because after the Choice Point compromise in 2006, banks were just tired of reissuing credit cards. And even with that robust framework, How many people raise a virtual hand? How many times have you got a new credit card in the last year or so? Right? We still see major breaches. So I'm a little cynical about how this framework might work, but eventually CMMC level is likely to be required for a lot of different businesses wanting to do work with any federal agency. And once the DoD forges this path and that the certification ecosystem is built and the auditors are ready, you know, other organizations are going to, other government agencies are going to jump to this certification process. I know from a financial aid perspective, education departments in higher ed have already been said that, you know, their processes have to start to look like NIST 800-171, right? So even that side is starting to, you know, lay the groundwork for a potential compliance with the new framework. Managed security service providers will need to support these MSPs. They're going to have to be certified as well, right? If you are working for a security company and your sole job is to maintain the security at one of these covered organizations, right? And you have access to the data, you're the custodian, you do the backups. So you could literally copy off the CUI. Your organization is likely going to have to be certified as well. And I think it's going to be adopted by other industry. You know, the auto industry has their own cyber frameworks. Insurance certainly does. But any data-centric organization, I think, is going to look to this as a means to ready and improve their own supply chains. So I'm going to bring this slide back up. And I want you to look at it for a moment and think about where you have worked previously, where you may work now, or where you might want to work in the future. And I guarantee whatever industry that you want to work in, their category of data is on this slide. So with that, I'm going to open up for questions. And we've got about 15 minutes or so. I'm going to throw my contact info there. So
yeah, we had a few comments in the chat. I mean, my initial thought was, is the government going to do anything to try to help these suppliers prepare? And it's kind of ironic if they're not. I guess, you know, vendors may be a dime a dozen to the government, but it would be nice if you put out a standard, you actually help people need it.
So they aren't currently, but that was one of the aspects of the deal. So earlier in March, the DoD did a full review of this because it is very costly for those small manufacturers, those small businesses, those micro-sized organizations to implement. I mean, think about what it would take to implement a SIM, a security information event management solution, if you have, you know, one server and you have 10 employees, right? You're going to spend more on that software than you would, you know, retooling all your IT. But they did say that in your solicitations, so in your bid responses for DoD work, you can add the cost of compliancy back in, right? So that's why we have, you know, $500 hammers that we sell the government. And I see that trend happening, right? So if you could somehow figure out what it costs per widget to maintain your compliancy, they're going to allow you to add that to the cost of that widget.
That was one of the first comments when you had the pictures of the airplanes. The comments were that the Chinese version is probably much cheaper.
Yeah, you know, they'll probably fall out of the sky, which is a good thing for their adversaries.
That's a bargain. Yeah, you should look at the chat, though. There's some comments because Dave and I kind of agreed that there should be some support from the government to get folks to the point of compliance. And if not, that's kind of ironic.
You know, it's a good question. And the way that I would compare this is with HIPAA. All right. Every healthcare covered entity that takes insurance, right, and processes billing via electronic transactions, they have to be covered by the HIPAA privacy and security rules. So it's a unfunded mandate. You have to do it. And if you don't, there's heavy fines. In this case, there's not so much. The stick is, if you aren't compliant, you may not be able to conduct business.
Yeah.
So if that's the lion's share of your business, then
it seems like that would be a snowball, because not only are you killing your supply chain that you kind of need as the government, but you're also putting a bunch of businesses out of business, which is further bringing the government and the nation down.
Correct. And I think that was also another aspect of the DoD review, is because, you know, it's maybe they have a longer phase in, or, you know, there's going to be sanitization requirements. So rather than downflowing the sensitive information all the way to tier three, tier four, tier five providers, you know, upper tier primes need to sanitize the data. So rather than sending you the full schematic of a wing when you're only developing a bolt, right? Don't send them that information. They don't need it to do what they need to do. And it just jeopardizes the entire project.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think a lot of, you know, subcontractors, vendors, whatever you call them, are just not aware. I mean, my sister is in accounting, but she does government defense contractors accounting. I'm sure she doesn't have any sensitive information, but it's just kind of interesting how much she actually does have access to. It's kind of, Daniel, we heard Daniel there. It's kind of interesting how much information she does have and probably doesn't even know how sensitive it is, to be honest.
Likely not, because she's probably never been informed.
You know, no, and I mean, she doesn't know anything about cybersecurity. You know, she does accounting. So it's like, she probably would see the information and not even realize it was sensitive. You know what I mean? That's what's scary about it.
Yeah. So. Absolutely.
That's very interesting. Yeah, there's a couple other comments in the chat. I don't know if you can see the chat now.
Let me see if you'll have to see the chat.
I think you have to stop sharing to be able to see all that.
Oh, okay.
And I did find a cool link. It's a link for a website where they're training assessors, and maybe that's one you were speaking of. It's not free, but
yeah. So there are a number of authorized trainers now. The training hit the street in September of this year. The certification test, is not due out until Q1 of next year. So my whole team is we're kind of hedging our bet. We're going to go through the training, but we're going to wait until the test hits the street, because I don't want long lead times between taking the training and then sitting for the exam. And if DoD makes major changes, then that's going to impact the training. So we're kind of waiting.
What kind of salaries do you think would come out of being an assessor? I mean, is it a lucrative career path to take that? Because it looks like there's different levels.
Yeah, I mean, it's considering to be certified, you have to do the training. You have to
pass.
There's three tests you have to pass. And you have to be shadowed on an assessment by a provisional assessor. So they have 100 people who've gone through a pilot training that can follow you around, and you have to pay those people $2,500 a day to watch you.
I saw that.
Right. So if the assessor, if you're, you know, we're non-for-profit, and when we do a readiness assessment, it's about a $10,000 engagement for about 6 days of work.
Yeah.
And so if you were an independent consultant, right, if you're a certified assessor and you contracted your services to a number of certified third-party assessment organizations, it could be quite lucrative. It's certainly going to be six figures.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah. For somebody who likes that kind of work, that's not bad. And certainly looks like there's going to be a huge demand for a long time.
Yeah, I think it will. If it gets legs, it's going to be...
Yeah.
You know, it'll be the next ISO, right? It'll be the next SOC 2. Everyone's going to want a SOC 2. Wow. They want their CMMC level.
So. That's pretty awesome.
Let's see. I love the idea of MFA, especially when it applies to the world of database administration. Active Directory determines the modify. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, with Microsoft releasing password lists, not really password lists, but, you know, token-based authentication. MFA is the right time. So yeah. Turn it on everywhere you can.
Yeah, very interesting.
Let's see.
And so how did you get into this? I mean, why is this your thing?
So I work for CyberTap, and CyberTap is Purdue's engagement arm of the university. So being a land-grant university, one of our core missions at Purdue is to give back to the citizens of Indiana. We wouldn't exist if John Perdue didn't donate, you know, thousands of acres of land to form Perdue. So the way we give back is any business in Indiana who pays taxes can come to the university and ask for 40 hours of business assistance. Well, since the 1980s, most of that has been in quality, Lean Six Sigma, process improvement. Let's say that you need a PhD caliber chemist because you're working on a new polymer and there's just, you need some whiteboarding, right? They'll dispatch a person out there. And so anything cyber since 2010 has we had to build a team because we started seeing cyber requests for services, for assistance, and we didn't have a team. So I came back to Perdue at that time. I was working with another organization doing security engineering. So I took this job because I was still at West Lafayette and it was perfect. So I built this team and we've been just doing small business assistance ever since. And because the Indiana Manufacturing Extension Partnership, so the NIST funded MEP center, every state has one. Some states have more than one center. These centers around the nation are designed to make manufacturing better in the United States. Keep jobs here, buy American, right? But we can only do that if we're competitive. Well, of the 800 manufacturers in Indiana that serve the DOD, they came to us. Hey, we need help because there aren't assessors yet and we don't know where we are and we need as much free assistance as possible.
That's cool.
That's how I got into it.
Yeah, that's cool that they're being proactive at least.
Yep.
And so we know it's coming and we're not ready.
Correct.
Wow, that's pretty cool. That's awesome. So what else does CyberTap do?
So we have this professional services team that I manage, but then we have a professional education side, and that's where we maintain the cyber range. We've got we have a few different courses. We call it ACE, Applied Cybersecurity Essentials. And there's four modules there. There's cyber foundations, there's enterprise security, vulnerability management, and ethical hacking. And so there's about 320 contact hours if you take all four modules. And they were meant to take someone with a STEM analytical background, not IT necessarily, and certainly not cyber. So zero prior knowledge in cybersecurity and make them into a tier one SOC analyst.
Very cool.
Within 16 weeks. Right. Cool. But this was a 16 weeks, 8 hours a day. Mm-hmm. And it worked for some of our partners because they just shipped us their new employees and they spent their first 16 weeks on the job with us.
Very cool.
So we took that experience and we broke it up. And now we have essentially the same content, the same lab, same instructional content, but we build it out for professionals. So if you can handle a couple hours a day, we can get you through the material and get you ready to be billable as a cyber SOC analyst.
But they don't get that service for free, right? The range training?
No. So there are some ACE badges that do include range, but, so we've got the ACE, the four modules, and then we have cyber range for really the experienced cyber mm-hmm. professional, because it, as you know, the range is not for the faint of heart, but it's immersive, it's realistic. Basically, it's a large virtualized environment. We throw attack traffic at the defenders on the blue side, and they've got to identify, remediate, and get back to a normal state. And then on the offensive, the red side, we give them a scenario. There's maybe a web server, there's a database server, there's other things, and their goal is to attack and exfiltrate data out of that environment.
Very cool. Very cool. I think that can resonate with a lot of people here who have been participating in our competitions. It sounds familiar.
Yes.
Coincidentally or not. That's awesome. Cool. So what else would you share with us today? What's your thought on certifications and the criticality of those? Clearly you have plenty of them.
I see that they're critical for a couple of different reasons. The first, and not so much from what you learn from pursuing them. I mean, that's probably the most important. But what it tells me as someone who hires cyber talent from time to time, and I'm going to have two new open positions in the next few weeks. So anybody in Indiana, look out for my social media feeds. I'll be posting jobs too. It lets me know that you're committed to the industry, right? Because, I mean, you don't need them to be successful in cyber, right? You can be just as knowledgeable. I know plenty of cyber professionals that aren't certified that are way smarter than me. But what it tells me is I'm willing to put forth the effort to, you know, learn, seat for the exam, and maintain the exam, not just take it and forget it, right? So after that three-year cycle on your CISSP, hopefully you've got your 120 hours of CPE so you can re-up it for another 3 years. That's what it tells me. And that's vital, because when you are on just a pile of resumes and I'm trying to figure out, you know, why do I hire Susie over John? If Susie is passionate about cybersecurity, the way that she tells me that is she's invested in these certifications. Yeah. They are a bit of an HR door opener as well, because, you know, recruiters, unless they focus on IT or cyber professionals, they really don't know how to write a job description, and they don't know how to look for a candidate. So what they look for are those credentials. So I think that's important too, at least for a young professional. But I wouldn't try to collect them as quickly, right? I've been in cyber for 17 years and I've got a small handful, but it's taken me 17 years to get there.
Right.
If I saw a new graduate that didn't have any work experience and they had two or three certifications, I'm going to discredit most of that.
Yeah.
Because it was part of their academic program, and it's just a different kind of, but 10 years from now, when you still have them, you know, they may not even be relevant anymore, but you're going to get credit for them. So,
right. Yeah, no, that makes sense. The same with the degree, really. I mean, in some cases, the subject of the degree doesn't matter. It's the fact that you got one.
And that's another selling point on the credentials, because, you know, if you're going to maintain the certifications, most of them, if they're worth anything, they're going to require continuing education. You know, I didn't have to do anything to say that I have a bachelor's degree or a master's degree or a PhD. I just, once you're done, you're done.
Yeah, that's true. It has an enduring value.
Absolutely.
That's awesome. Well, this is great. I think it was very informative. I think I learned a lot, and I'm sure everyone else did as well. And
I'll share the slide deck on Slack, just because there's a lot of links, okay, and my notes are probably more informative than the actual slides. So
yeah. And you know that we convert this to a podcast, so the podcast will be available if somebody wants to listen in, but that's great. If you want to share the slides too, that's great.
Okay.
You can check those out. And thank you. And yeah, in case anybody hasn't seen George before, George is always on our Slack channel. He'll pop up every once in a while and share things. So if you want to reach out to him through the Slack channel, you can do so. And as he mentioned earlier, please join him on LinkedIn if you're not already. But I appreciate your time today. Thank you so much. I appreciate you helping us celebrate the wonderful Cybersecurity Awareness Month. Yeah, I appreciate
you're welcome.
We took the time tonight. And thank you, everyone else. I will post the recording soon, and there'll be a podcast later. I appreciate everyone coming tonight. Thank you. Thanks, George.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Have a good night. Thanks, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Bye.